Welcome, this is Marco. I am back after a two-week absence. You are listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.9. I had surgery on both hands and I couldn't use my hands for a few weeks. So that was on September 29th and I still had to work, so it was hard. So I cut out some other things that I didn't have to do. So I'm not nice to be back, and one thing that I know that happened while I was away is that I lost the continuity of what I would talk about week to week. So for example, if I had a show, I could talk about what was the story of the day, follow up from the previous week on that same story. So now I haven't been here for a while, and there is often, it seems to me now, since I've been away, I looked on Live Science and there was a lot of stories, but they were kind of like, oh, this supernova swallowed this star and things like that. So it's not really the story that was evolving for a while, which was the Artemis mission. And as I said before, I was disappointed by it because something went wrong, fuel leaks and stuff like that. And then they rolled it into the building to, they said, avoid the storm that was coming, but I think it was more than that. I think they were embarrassed. So they made that excuse and rolled it in, and they're going to start again. And I guess if that's what they have to do, then that's what they have to do. And I had been following the Webb telescope for years, and I could say almost for decades. So I was following that, and then delay after delay came, and it finally launched about, I think, 14 years late, something like that. I waited a long time for that. Why not have the patience to wait for this Artemis moon mission? But it was an exciting thing, the Artemis moon mission. A lot of people are thinking there was a lot of lost time there because they could have carried on from the Apollo program, but they didn't. So I flicked to NASA TV the other day and they were talking about something. I was kind of busy doing something useless like playing some game, and then I kind of followed it, and it looked like some kind of arm was out there. I don't know if it's the Canada arm, but the arm that is, I think, they used on the space shuttle, which was called the Canada arm or Canadarm. And they were doing other things, like the space shuttles would bring satellites or things up into space and then they launched them from there. So that was what was so useful about the space shuttle. So I didn't pay attention much, maybe I should have, but a lot of other people, if they saw that, it would have bored them, but didn't bore me. So I haven't been doing much of astronomy, I haven't been talking about it, so I kind of lost my sense of following up a story from the previous week. So we know now that the Artemis mission will be delayed, I think, until at least November 15th, and there's not much news on it. And that's what I do see, that there are major networks that follow it, and even CTV, they follow it and they tell stories about astronomy and certain asteroids and things like that. So when there's a major story, they follow it a lot more than usual. But since the Artemis mission went in back into the VAB building, I think that's what it's called, Vehicle Assembly Building, we haven't heard much about what is happening with that. It's actually almost like a silence, a dead silence. And I do remember when Webb was delayed, there was still a lot of stories about its equipment and how its cameras will work and what kind of equipment they'd have on board. So at least I did learn a lot about the different components of Webb and how it was made. And if someone gave me a test now, I have to recall it, I probably wouldn't very good. But I still was very entertained by watching all the things about Webb. So now I went, as I said, I went to the Live Science website. It's like a spaghettified star gets burped out of a black hole, stuff like that. And this asteroid, this, and but one thing that I did see on the Live Science was the DART mission. So the asteroid redirect mission, where they shot something at the asteroid and they said it was a smashing success. And it was actually the first time in history that an asteroid had been targeted in that way. So apparently the astronomers learned a lot about that kind of stuff. Now here's one website from NASA.com, and the story is called Resupply Mission for NASA Carries Scientific Experiments to Space Station. So I did learn or read that there is something like 300 or more experiments going on in the space shuttle at one time. And of course, some of them would be how things are different in microgravity or no gravity. So those have always interested me. But here's one that's really, I talked a little bit about it. And okay, I want to go to this topic first, but here I'm just scrolling down. It said, assessing how plants adapt to space. So what I did read before was plants are kind of used to having gravity around, and they're directed or guided by gravity. So when their roots come out, the roots are pulled down by gravity and things like that. All of a sudden, when there's no gravity, how do the plants react to that? And that's the same with fire. I read a story a few weeks ago about how the flame in space is different than the flame on Earth. It's almost like a dome. It burns at a much lower temperature. So the scientists for that story were talking about using that to burn fuels, somehow transferring that experiment to space or to Earth where there is gravity. But the part they wanted to transfer was burning fuels at lower temperatures. So apparently that's going to save fuel or something it's going to save. So there are all kinds of spin-offs from space. But there is an article here on NASA.gov, and well, it's one of the subsections, it's one of the paragraphs here, and I talked about it before, how certain African countries now wanted constellations in space. They want to get satellites into space. So here's one, a part of a paragraph says, first satellites from Uganda and Zimbabwe. Birds dash five, so that's big B, B I, or big I, big R, big D, big S dash five. Birds five is a constellation of CubeSats. Pearl Africa Sat 1, the first satellite developed by Uganda. ZimSat 1, Zimbabwe's first satellite. And Taka from Japan. These are apparently called the Birds 5 satellites. Birds 5 performs multispectral observations of Earth using a commercial off-the-shelf camera and demonstrates a high-energy electronic measuring instrument. The statistical data collected could help distinguish bare ground from forest and farmland and possibly indicate the quality of agricultural growth. This could help improve the livelihood of citizens of Uganda and Zimbabwe. So I was talking about this before, where there's lots of spin-offs in space that the African countries use, for example, to mitigate disasters, or when temperatures are high, or when weather is bad, or when a volcano breaks, something like that. So this seems like going to be happening more and more in the future, since Zimbabwe and Uganda are doing it. Who knows what other with other countries are doing it. So we know the European Space Agency, which I don't talk about enough. I really basically don't talk about it at all. But I said one time I should get into stories from the European Space Agency, because I do believe that, for example, the I guess they call observatories that are up there, for example, the Fermi Observatory and the one, the Chandrasekhar that does, I believe, in infrared light, the European Space Agency has, I wouldn't say a duplicate, but has the same thing on their side, which they use, and they coordinate with NASA. And in many observations, when NASA or the European Space Agency is coordinating their experiments, they use all kinds of satellites that look or view in different spectrums of the electromagnetic spectrum. And the European Space Agency apparently has as many of these observatories or satellites, maybe not as many, but possibly close to how many the United States have. And we see here Japan's involved, and China's involved, and Russia's involved. And we know those countries are involved, and Canada's involved because I think the U.S. is so nice to us and lets us get involved, because we're not doing much on our own. So now we have these African countries that want to get involved. So I was watching the NASA channel a few weeks ago, and they were interviewing government officials and scientists in Africa, and they were explaining how these satellites, NASA provides services where they provide all this information, and apparently they said it's almost like necessary, and it's such a pleasure for them to get all this information from the satellites. So here we're saying that Uganda with its Pearl Africa Sat-1, it's a CubeSat, little satellite, and Zimbabwe with its ZimSat-1, and Taka from Japan. So there are lots and lots of satellites. And the story I read a couple months ago was how every year records are broken in terms of the number of satellites sent into space, the number of launches, and they said this year is going to be no different, and the future there's going to be more and more and more. So we are a space-faring race. There's no denying it, and there's no denying how much benefit different countries get from it. So I'm going to continue with this story. They are the Zimbabwe's ZimSat-1 satellite and Uganda's Pearl Africa Sat-1 and Taka from Japan. So I bet, and it's probably going to happen, that a lot of other countries will want to do this, from Africa, from any nation. A cross-border university project, BIRDS provides students from developing nations with hands-on satellite development, laying a foundation for similar space technology projects in their home countries. That ultimately could lead to sustainable space programs there, which is a great thing, because I did talk about how the Chinese are exploring parts of the South Pole of the Moon, and I believe the Russians and the Chinese are starting to cooperate on that, and we know that the Artemis program is the American program, with the European Space Agency contributing, and Japan. I'm not sure how much Canada is contributing, but we do see that there is this rush to get into space. So here's another example of an experiment. It's called Ovarian Cell Development in Microgravity, sponsored by NASA and the Italian Space Agency, and coordinated by the Italian Space Agency's OvoSpace, examines the effect of microgravity on bovine cell cultures, research that could improve fertility treatments on Earth and help prepare for future human settlement in space. So I never thought about that. If someone would have asked me what's important to develop for when people eventually do move into space one day, and then here's one: ovarian cell development and microgravity. Principal investigator Mariano Bizzari with the Department of Experimental Medicine, Sapienza University of Rome, explains that living for prolonged times in the reduced gravity of the Moon or Mars could impact fertility. So says Bizzari, and quote, "This threatens the goal of establishing permanent or extended settlements beyond Earth. Deregulation of the reproductive functions also may pose additional health risks. Our results could improve understanding of egg development and identify targets for countermeasures and treatments to protect reproductive potential on space missions. This investigation also could support development of treatments to improve or restore fertility in people on Earth." So with all the stuff I've read, and about 5 years ago, I directly targeted this thing about spin-offs from space, and it comes up every now and then, but there are so many spin-offs that they have made a website of it. So here's another one, mudflow mixtures. Climate change and global warming are contributing to increasing occurrence of wildfires. When a wildfire burns plants, combusted chemicals create a thin layer of soil that repels rainwater. Rain then erodes the soil and can turn into catastrophic mudflows that carry heavy boulders and debris downhill, causing significant damage to infrastructure, watersheds, and human life. Post-wildlife mudflow microstructure, this is called the Tango Lab Mission -28, sponsored by the International Space Station National Lab, evaluates the composition of these mudflows, which includes salt, sand, water, and trapped air. So says Ingrid Tomac, an assistant professor in the University of California, San Diego's Structural Engineering Department, and quote, "Gravity plays a crucial role in the process by driving air up and out of the mixture and particles down to the bottom of the water. Removing gravity, therefore, could provide insights into the internal structure dynamics of these sand, water, air mixtures and a baseline for their behavior. Results could improve understanding of the fundamental mechanisms that govern past wildfire debris movement, including how mudflows trap air bubbles and can carry heavy boulders. This investigation also could help develop and validate fundamental equations to model and predict the speed and velocity of debris flows and their effect on houses, infrastructures, and natural obstacles." So I think it was one time in Italy when there was this mud flow, and I believe in California, and also when I saw the volcano erupting in Hawaii. I don't think that could be a mud flow, but basically how it destroyed so many things. So here, that's a useful thing. Now here's another one. Oh, this is the one that I talked about earlier, and I couldn't wait to get to it. Assessing how plants adapt to space. Plants exposed to spaceflight undergo changes that involve the addition of extra information to their DNA, which regulates how genes turn on or off, but does not change the sequence of the DNA itself. This process is known as epigenetic change. Plant Habitat -03 assesses whether such adaptations in one generation of plants grow in space can transfer to the next generation. The long-term goal of the investigation is to understand how epigenetics can contribute to adaptive strategies plants use on future missions to provide food and other services. Results also could support the development of strategies for adapting crops and other economically important plants for growth in marginal and reclaimed habitats on Earth. So that just struck a chord in my brain. I guess I might have some chords in there, but let's say you send a mission to Mars or to the moon, and all of a sudden, what are they going to eat? Well, they have to grow their food. They can't bring a big herd of cows. So in this small spacecraft, which carries 4 people, so they're going to grow some plants. So they are going to, in the Ryan spacecraft or whatever is attached to the Ryan spacecraft, plants need to be grown. And I guess a lot of the things they're learning about how plants adapt to microgravity or no gravity, that's what they will need, this knowledge, when they fly to some place like Mars, when they're in space off the Earth for 6 months. So it's just mind-boggling, the things that you can think of. For example, the one, ovarian cell development in microgravity, then how plants grow in microgravity. Okay, I'm going to read on. In earlier experiments, researchers noticed that many genes associated with epigenetic modifications in plants were expressed differently in space. In additional studies, researchers caused plants to be deficient in key genes associated with specific epigenetic change. These plants were more affected by space flights than their wild-type naturally occurring counterparts and ground control. So as I said a bit earlier, that what I did read about this was how plants are guided by gravity. So their roots, when they start to grow, they grow down. How are they going to react in gravity? A principal investigator, Anna Lisa Paul, a professor at the University of Florida, says, in quote, "This suggests that these changes play an important role in the physiological adaptation of plants to the space flight environment. The next question, and the subject of the experiment, is whether these space flight induced epigenetic changes are carried to the next generation of plants and could confer an adaptive advantage for that environment." So there are a lot of bioprinting tissues, whatever that means. So all these things that I have read, they are under the, here are details on some of the scientific investigations traveling to the space station on this mission. And as I said, there's probably 300 or more experiments going on to the space station at any one time. So here's another issue, bioprinting tissues. The biofabrication facility, BFF, successfully printed a partial human knee meniscus and a large volume of human heart cells during its first trip to space in 2019. So this is called bioprinting tissues. Wow. Now the payload is returning to the microgravity laboratory with new capabilities to further human tissue printing research. The 3D bioprinter tests whether microgravity enables the printing of tissue samples of higher quality than those printed on the ground. The long-term goal is to use 3D bioprinting technologies to help alleviate organ shortages for patients in need of transplants by printing replacement organs and tissues. So says Redwire Executive Vice President of In-Space Manufacturing and Operations, John Vellinger, and quote, "The research being conducted with BFF has exciting implications for the future of human health. Besides providing a clearer benefit to our lives on Earth, advancing this technology on the International Space Station now is a great way to prepare for work on the commercial space stations of the future, which could be outfitted with critical research technology such as BFF," end quote. Launching on a future mission, BFF's Meniscus 2 will use the upgraded facility to evaluate using BFF to 3D print knee cartilage tissue using bioinks and cells. Demonstration of further capabilities for tissue fabrication in space also supports continued and expanded commercial use of the space station for fabricating tissues and organs for transplant on the ground. BFF Meniscus 2 is sponsored by the International Space Station National Lab. So here's a photo. Here's a picture. It says, "A water droplet on the flat surface of hydrophobic fine sand stands up and has a more rounded shape than compared to normal hydrophilic sand. K catastrophic post-wildlife mudflows studies the formation and stability of this bubble sand structure in microgravity to improve the understanding, modeling, and predicting of mudflows and supports development of innovative solutions to prevent catastrophic post-fire events. And let's see if we can... Okay, there, I want to read this subtitle. There's a picture of kind of machine. It says, the Biofabrication Facility, BFF, shown here with the Advanced Space Experiment Processor, or ADSEP, returns to the space station after upgrades. The facility hosts BFF Meniscus 2, which attempts to 3D print a meniscus or knee cartilage tissue using bioinks and cells. Kind of interesting. I guess that is something that interests me, because even when I was 5 years old, I would kneel in church and it was agonizing pain. I couldn't kneel down. So what happened is I was told by my doctors later that one of my legs is shorter, so my legs don't track precisely at the knee. So what happens, they go to the side, and then my cartilage on my right knee, the outside cartilage, is worn out. I don't know if it's totally worn out, but it's been a lifelong thing. So maybe they can make me a new knee cartilage. Wouldn't that be great? So let me read the paragraph that I misread in the beginning. It says, resupply mission for NASA carries scientific experiments to space station. The 18th Northrop Grumman commercial resupply service mission for NASA to the International Space Station carries scientific investigations of topics such as plant mutations and mudflow structure, along with a demonstration of camera technology and small satellites from Japan, Uganda, and Zimbabwe. The Cygnus spacecraft carrying these investigations to the orbiting laboratory is scheduled for liftoff no earlier than November 6th from the Mid-Atlantic Regional Spacecraft Spaceport at NASA's Wallops, so that's W-A-L-L-O-P-S, flight facility on Wallops Island, Virginia. So, for example, when I was talking about Artemis, I talk about it week to week. So the story developed, and I'd have something like that to talk about. And then the next week, I talk about the things that have since developed. So I don't have that now, so I'm just starting on new topics. And one thing that also strikes me is, let's say if this NASA mission was successful, their first launch or their second launch was successful, they would have been in space now for probably a month or something, and there would have been a lot of new information coming in about that. So I hope it gets off the ground soon, and people like me need this kind of news. Okay, I am going to go for a break now, and when I come back, I will talk more astronomy. This is Marco AstroTalk on CITR 101.9.
Hey there.
Barev.
We're the Armenian Students Association, and we're here to bring together everyone,
Armenians and non-Armenians,
who are interested in learning about the Armenian culture here at UBC.
Find us on Facebook at ASAUBC to stay up to date. We look forward to seeing you at our future events.
It's not just rich people that own the media.
I own my 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 media.
The Media Co-op is a grassroots national news network that's owned by its members. Join us today at mediacoop.ca/join.
Okay, thank you for coming back with me. This is Marco. You're listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9. So I'm browsing through the NASA website because I thought the topics on livescience.com were worth even reading. It was like something is pulled, like, example, they said, we capture a star that we thought a supernova had eaten up. Oh no, sorry, a black hole eaten up, and then it spit it out again, it burped it out. So, I don't know what kind of useful information we can get out of that. So what I'm going to do now, I'm going to stay on the NASA page and talk about, now, about Artemis. So there's an article I found, said NASA sets date for next launch attempt for Artemis 1 Moon mission. And it doesn't tell the date that this article came out. But anyway, again, the topic is called NASA Sets Date for Next Launch Attempt for Artemis 1 Moon Mission. NASA is targeting the next launch attempt of the Artemis mission for Monday, November 14th, with liftoff of the Space Launch System, SLS, rocket carrying the Orion spacecraft planned during a 69-minute launch window that opens at 12:07 a.m. Eastern Time. So that's in about 3 weeks and 6 days. Artemis 1 is an uncrewed flight test. So as I said, I don't know if I said this at the beginning of the show, I'm doing this show on Tuesday, October the 18th. When I say things, it's not like I'm talking right now, Thursday, but I'm doing this show, recording it at Monday, and it will play on the 20th. So there's a launch window that opens for 69 minutes at 12:07 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. Artemis 1 is an uncrewed flight test to launch SLS and send Orion around the moon and back to Earth to thoroughly test its system before flights with astronauts. Inspections and analyses over the previous week have confirmed minimal work is required to prepare the rocket and spacecraft to roll out to launch pad 39B at Kennedy Space Center in Florida following the rollback due to Hurricane Ian. So that sounds nice. It says here, minimal work is required to prepare the rocket and spacecraft. So that sounds very good. Teams will perform standard maintenance to repair minor damage to the foam and cork on the thermal protection system and recharge or replace batteries on the rocket, several secondary payloads, and the flight termination system. I think what the flight termination system is, let's say they launch and then something catastrophic happens and during the launch, they can blow up the rocket so it doesn't fly off and all of a sudden veer into Earth and crash on some big building or people. The agency plans to roll the rocket back to the launch pad as early as Friday, November 4th, which would be about 2.5 weeks from now, which I would say, yippee, that's great. I would love that to happen. NASA has requested backup launch opportunities for Wednesday, November 16th at 1:04 a.m. and Saturday, November 19th at 1:45 a.m., which are both two-hour launch windows. A launch on November 14 would result in a mission duration of about 25 and a half days with a splashdown in the Pacific Ocean Friday, December 6. So it says here the mission duration would be 25 and a half days. I thought it was going to be about 6 weeks. So I guess because of the delays, I don't know, it seems they have to splash down on Friday, December 9th. It says about Artemis. Artemis is the first step to the next era of human exploration. Together with commercial and international partners, NASA will establish a sustainable presence on the moon to prepare for a mission or prepare for missions to Mars. This blog will be a source of information on Artemis launch and exploration progress, covering updates across our science, technology, and human exploration programs. Once we're ready to fly, check out this blog further for launch updates and other mission operations. So let's pause for a sec here because, believe it or not, I like Star Wars. I like watching them again and again. So I was watching when Leia and them are in track by the First Order. So every time they go to light speed, the First Order can track where they go and they just reappear in the sky above them. So I'm thinking, well, doesn't it take fuel to go to light speed, or is it just the process? And you never see these people eating. Sometimes you see them in a bar drinking, and there's a big fight that breaks out. But anyway, how is it that you have a giant spacecraft that can carry so many people and has so many creature comforts and droids that are working, like, let's say, medical assistants? And droids that do this and droids that do that, and especially these big, I don't know what they're called, but the First Order, and when they have these big spaceships, and how can you supply all the people and all the creatures or droids working on there, which is something that we will have to figure out if there is ever an attempt to go to Mars. So this is the wrap-up on Artemis. So I was very interested in Artemis because it broke my heart almost when it didn't launch. So now I took a 2-week off period because I had surgery. So now I'm going to go to the next thing about Artemis. So NASA invites media to simulated Artemis moon mission site in Arizona. NASA and JAXA, which is the Japanese space agency's teams conducting Artemis field tests in Arizona with astronauts, engineers, and scientists to practice in a simulated lunar surface environment. So they're showing the astronauts here, which is pretty cool. And I did join the OSIRIS-REx team. I was an ambassador for them, and after COVID ruined everything, I was thinking of giving lectures and talks about this OSIRIS-REx mission, but it was headquartered in Arizona, so I think a lot of things for NASA go on in Arizona, and a lot of the experiments are probably there or in California because the desert, it's probably like what the environment is like on the moon and Mars. And when I was watching a TV show about all the observatories and the telescopes on the Atacama Desert in Chile, it was said that this Atacama Desert is one of the driest places on Earth. And they talked about the amount of rainfall, which is minuscule. But then I believe they also said that the moon or Mars is way, way, way drier than the Atacama Desert. So there's things that have to be overcome, and they think they can solve these issues, like finding ice water in under the lips of the craters of the moon and probably Mars as well. So I don't think Mars has any water, flowing water on it. So that's going to be a big thing because water is a very important commodity. And the show I saw on TV about the Colorado River, how it's running dry, and a lot of farmers along that river are being told, we're going to give you less water. And it seems precedence is given to Los Angeles because that's what supplies their water. It's a big city. And when something similar comes up in the future, how do you divide things up among competing parts or factions that want the same thing, and all of a sudden they can't get it, can't get as much as they need? So imagine the amount of water we have on Earth, where our surface, I believe it's about 71% of our surface is covered with water. And then you go to the moon and Mars, and there's no water, or very little water. So I do believe also that the water in the craters of the moon, hydrogen can be taken out for fuel, and oxygen can be taken out of H2O for breathing. So the NASA people and all the astronomers are figuring these things out as we speak. So through Desert Rats, NASA and its partner are practicing rover operations for future Artemis missions. So what does RATS stand for? It usually says that. Oh, here it is. Desert Research and Technology Study, which is Desert RATS. Pretty cool. The training mission, which kicked off on Saturday, October 11th, which was the week before, is running through Saturday, October 22nd, and primarily focuses on conducting presumed rover operations. The skill set is a key element of future moon missions, starting with Artemis 7 in 2030. So they have Artemis 7 planned. Wow. NASA's in-person only event includes an opportunity to speak with subject matter experts and ride inside the prototype moon rover. In 1987, I went to Houston and we rode inside one of those rovers. I was lucky enough to go there with a lot of rockets outside, take a lot of pictures of them. And then inside, there was a lot of free exhibits. We didn't pay anything to get in. And I believe that's when I paid my $5 to go inside some kind of space vehicle, and they give us a simulated test. Maybe it was just like an amusement park ride. But anyway, I do remember that. And here it's talking about a media day schedule is as follows. 12:30 p.m. arrival, 1 p.m. overview briefing and questions and answered, and 1:30 p.m. speak to subject matter experts and ride a rover. Wow. Reporters wishing to attend must request accreditation by 5 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, Thursday, October 20, which is coming right up, from Niloufar Ramji at 281-483-5111. Or Niloufar, so that's Niloufar dot Ramji at NASA.gov. Simulating lunar missions, desert rats crews are traversing the desert, living and working in the rover and exiting to conduct moonwalks. NASA and its partner, Japanese Aerospace Exploration Agency, JAXA, will gather data about the pressurized rover designs, cabin configurations, driving modes, timeline constraints, and mission operations to support potential design concepts for futurized pressurized rovers. So let's look at this title again. It says, NASA invites media to simulated Artemis moon mission site in Arizona. Wow, lots of things going on. Okay. Through Artemis, NASA will land the first woman and the first person of color on the moon, paving the way for a long-term, sustainable lunar presence and serving as a stepping stone for future astronaut missions to Mars. Missions simulations on Earth help prepare. Sorry, some pop-up came in and just went over the line I was reading. Okay, so these stupid technological things. Mission simulations on Earth help prepare humans for the challenges of deep space exploration and journeying farther into the solar system. Learn more about NASA's Artemis mission at https://www.nasa.gov/Artemis, A-R-T-E-M-S. So that's pretty easy. And we are done with this Artemis thing. So I think what I should do now, give my voice a rest, give you guys ears a rest. I will go on the break, and when we come back, I'm going to have a secret surprise topic that I'm going to talk about. This is Marco. You are listening to AstroTalk on CITR 101.9.
Red Cat Records is an amazing artist-owned and operated record store. Shop from their diverse online music collection and get free shipping within Vancouver and the Lower Mainland with the purchase of two or more LPs. If you would like to further support them through the evolving COVID-19 crisis, you can do so by buying a gift card to use at a later date. Visit www.redcat.ca for more information.
Enjoy British Columbia's beautiful wilderness with the UBC Varsity Outdoors Club. Try your hand at hiking, backcountry skiing, rock climbing, kayaking, and much more. Whether you're a beginner or an expert, we have trips happening every week, usually at no cost. Check us out online at ubc-voc.com.
Okay, welcome back. This is Marco. You're listening to AstroTalk. And I don't know why I am going to read this, but I am going to read this. It'll take about a minute. Correction. Apollo astronaut James McDivitt dies at age 93. So, former astronaut James M. McDivitt, who commanded the Gemini 4 and Apollo 9 missions, died October 13th. McDivitt passed away peacefully in his sleep, surrounded by his friends and family in Tucson, Arizona. He was 93 years old. McDivitt was born in Chicago, graduated from Kalamazoo Central High School, and went on to aeronautical engineering at the University of Michigan. graduating first in his class in 1959. He joined the Air Force and retired with the rank of Brigadier General. He flew 145 combat missions during the Korean War in F-80 and F-86 aircraft. He was a graduate at the U.S. Air Force Experimental Test Pilot School and the U.S. Air Force Aerospace Research. McDivitt was selected as an astronaut by NASA in September 1962 as part of NASA's second astronaut class. He first flew in space as a commander of the Gemini 4 mission in June 1965. McDivitt was joined by fellow Air Force pilot Ed White on the program's most ambitious flight to date. During Gemini 4, White would become the first American to venture outside a spacecraft for what officially is known as an extra-vehicular activity, or as the world has come to know it, as a spacewalk. In the following years, it was a skill that allowed Apollo explorers to walk on the moon and American astronauts and their partners from around the world to build the International Space Station. The mission's four-day duration nearly doubled NASA astronauts' previous time in space to that point, with the longest American space flight previously being George Cooper in 34-hour Mercury 9 mission. McDivitt's second space flight as the commander of Apollo 9 played a critical role in landing the first humans on the moon. This was the first flight of the complete set of Apollo hardware and was the first flight of the lunar module. The mission launched from NASA's Kennedy Center on March 3, 1969, with Commander James McDivitt, Commander Module Pilot David Scott, and Lunar Module Pilot Russell Skiwikart. After launch, Apollo 9 entered Earth orbit and the crew performed an engineering test of the first crewed launch module, nicknamed Spider, from beginning to end. They simulated the maneuvers that would be performed during actual lunar missions. During the mission, the astronauts performed a series of flight tasks with the command and service module and the lunar module. Let's see if I can go further on in this. McDivitt logged more than 14 days in space. After Apollo 9, he became manager of lunar landing operations and led a team that planned the lunar exploration program. He also became manager of the Apollo spacecraft program, guiding this program through Apollo 12, 13, 14, 15, and 16. So as I have mentioned before, Apollo 1 is the one where the astronauts were in the capsule. They were just testing it. And there were some astronauts outside the capsule on the launch site. And they were pumping a lot of oxygen into the capsule. I guess that made sense. All of a sudden, a spark ignited a big fire, and all people outside could do was just watch their fellow astronauts get burned up and die inside the capsule. So there was a lot of groundwork laid before all these other missions could proceed. So I guess it was a good thing to do to review astronaut James A. McDivitt, because he's just one of the people that had a big part in bringing us to where we are today. Okay, so what I also saw on the Apollo, or on the NASA TV program, and as I read here a bit earlier on this show, was how Uganda and Zimbabwe want to launch satellites in space. So I saw that happen with the space shuttles. So a lot of satellites were launched, were packed into the space shuttle's compartments, and when the space shuttle reached outer space, then they would open the hatches and these satellites would come spinning out. So I don't know how many satellites there are, and I don't know how much America has or how much Europe has, but here's one example. It said NASA SpaceX crew, four astronauts safely splashed down. Oh, sorry, that's not the one. I thought I was going to read something. Okay. Here it is. So it says, image of the day, JPSS-2 stacked atop LOFTID spacecraft. So is that an example of a satellite being launched into space somehow? So I will read this because I'm not reading just for the JPS and the LOFTID spacecraft. I was interested because this show on NASA TV showed how the space shuttle played such a big role in launching a lot of satellites. So I will read this article now. It's called JPSS-2 Stacked Atop LOFTID Spacecraft. So here it shows some kind of people in white suits putting something on top of something else. It looks like a rocket. Preparations continue for the launch of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's NOAA Joint Polar Satellite System 2, JPSS-2, so Joint Polar Satellite System 2, satellite. On Tuesday, October 4th, JPSS-2 was attached to the payload adapter inside the Astrotech Space Operations Facility at Vandenberg Space Force Base in California. On Wednesday, October 5th, technicians and engineers completed the mail process using, does it say mail or mate? The mate process, M-A-T-E. The mate process using a crane to lift JPSS-2 and attach it to the top of the stack containing the reentry vehicle to the low Earth orbital flight test of an inflatable decelerator or lofted technology demonstration. Wow. How many things we don't know about with NASA, huh? To prepare lofted for stacking, technicians mated the reentry vehicle payload adapter interface ring to lofted inside building 836 at Vandenberg. Then the team mated the payload adapter separation system inside the reentry vehicle payload adapter canister. Finally, technicians lifted the payload adapter canister over the reentry vehicle to complete the stack. The lofted stack was moved to Astrotech to complete mating operations with JPSS-2. Next up, the assembly will be encapsulated in a protective payload fairing. After encapsulation, the team will transport the encapsulated spacecraft to Space Launch Complex 3, where a crane will hoist it up for attachment to the second stage of the United Launch Alliance Atlas IV 401 rocket. JPSS-2 and lofted together measure approximately 27 feet tall. Yeah, it didn't look that big. Not like Artemis. Launch is targeted for November 1st from Vandenberg, NASA's Launch Services Program, based at the agency's Kennedy Space Center in Florida, is managing the launch. So the reason I read this article was kind of surprised. Missions I didn't know about, how many of the satellites I didn't know about, how much I didn't know about the experience, the type of experience going on, experiments in space, and the International Space Station, all the stuff going on. So there's stuff like NASA's Lucy spacecraft prepares to swing by Earth. NASA's Swift Fermi missions detect exceptional cosmic blast. And NASA invites media to launch a water monitoring satellite. So I'm going to read that a bit. So it does seem there's a lot of things going on in NASA, and things that, even though I keep track of some of these things, the amount of things going on is just mind-boggling, and the kind of expertise NASA has acquired and proficiency it does to design all these things and all these things in space going on, it's really the beginning of a space age. And so I'll read about NASA invites media to launch a water monitoring satellite. So it shows an artist concept of the SWOT spacecraft. I try to see what SWOT, okay, it's a surface water and ocean topography SWOT satellite. The SWOT mission will measure the height of the world's oceans, rivers, and lakes, helping scientists to measure how fresh and saltwater bodies change over time. Media accreditation is now open for the upcoming launch of the Surface Water and Ocean Topography Satellite, SWOT, a Pathfinder mission about Earth's water that will use new technology to address climate change and its impact on our environment. So it says it is Pathfinder mission. So I think that's what they called the vehicles before the launch of the Voyager spacecraft in 1977. So I don't know the exact year, but I believe two Pathfinder rockets were, missions were sent. I believe one of the objectives was people still didn't know, or scientists didn't know, how dense the asteroid belt was. Could a rocket ship actually fly through the asteroid belt? Like we see on Star Wars when Han Solo and Leia and the other people on the ship were being followed by Darth Vader, so they went into an asteroid belt. And it seems that the asteroid belt is nowhere near as dense as that. So SWAT will, it's a Pathfinder mission, launch Voyager, and they've launched a lot of spacecraft, so they found it wasn't as dense as they thought it had been. Maybe the same type of experiment was carried out when the Cassini spacecraft flew in between the rings of Saturn and Saturn itself, because they didn't know what would happen. So there was a lot learned about that, as the, not here, but in the Pathfinder missions, there was no way to know how thick the asteroid belt was. Could actual spacecraft fly through the asteroid belt? So that was the Pathfinder mission before the Voyager mission. NASA and SpaceX are targeting no earlier than Monday, December 5th, for launch of the Earth-facing satellite on a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket from Space Launch Complex -4 East at Vandenberg Space Force Base in California. U.S. and international media interested in attending this launch must apply no later than 5 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time on Thursday, October 27th. Media accreditation requests should be submitted at https://media.kcs.nasa.gov. A copy of NASA's media accreditation policy is available online. And for questions, call Kennedy's newsroom at 321-867-2468, not that anybody will call them, or email ksc-media-accreditation, ACCREDITAT@mail.nasa.gov. I am now going to sign out because us humans go Betty Bye. So it's after midnight. I'm going to download this and send it to the station. So thank you for listening. This has been Marco. You've been listening to Astro Talk on CITR 101.
Hi, this is Audie from Broken Bones, and you're listening to CITR.
You know what I could go for right now? Authentic flour tortillas pan-fried until golden brown.
Yum!
Or vegan taco kits filled with traditional Mexican chilies and spices.
Yeah, that sounds good.
Or how about vegan potato and chorizo taquitos?
How can I get these foods immediately?
Buy Lita's Mexican Foods.
Sounds delicious. Tell me more.
Lita's Mexican Foods is a female-managed, plant-based Mexican food innovator in BC. Their products come prepackaged and frozen at tons of local grocery stores around Metro Vancouver. Not to mention they can be cooked in under 10 minutes.
Wow, that sounds perfect for me. I've been so busy lately and dinner takes so long to make. Where can I get my hands on some Lita's Mexican Foods?
Lots of places. Whole Foods, Choices, Stong's, Vegan Supply, Donald's, and even UBC Bookstore. Hey, where are you going?
To buy some Lita's Mexican Foods. See you later.
See ya. Do you love being caffeinated? And do you hate that greedy, soulless international conglomerates are succeeding in the cutthroat world of coffee? Sounds like local coffee roasters Trek Coffee is for you. Trek Coffee is 100% indigenous and military veteran owned and operated. Let's keep small businesses thriving. Stop by Sunshine Convenience on 4th, the Super Value on Commercial, or grocery checkout in the Nest to pick up some Trek Coffee today. Do you want to change the state of the world, but instead you keep buying material goods